UK government might have shut down?
Let's end this shutdown right now. Let's put people back to work.
Listen, there's never been a president in our history that did not negotiate over the debt limit. Never. Not once.
But you can count on us. Welcome to News One Now with Roland Martin.
Good morning, folks. I'm Roland Martin. Next on News One Now, what the hell happened at the Academy Awards? Oh, my God. Talk about a major screw-up as Moonlight wins Best Picture after they announced La La Land. Yeah, we'll show you what happened. In Atlanta, former Labor Secretary Tom Perez elected chair of the Democratic National Committee, beating out Congressman Keith Ellison. We will talk with Cordell Belcher, top Democratic pollster, about what that means for the party moving forward. The NAACP is discussing an economic boycott of North Carolina. They say it's over a plethora of issues, including voter suppression and the change of laws in that state by Republicans. We'll break that down as well with our panel. Also, HBCUs are in the spotlight this week as President Donald Trump is expected to sign an executive order as early as today that will give the schools a major financial boost. We'll discuss that as well. All right, folks, it's time to bring the funk on News One Now on TV One.
For Best Picture.
You're impossible. Come on. La La Land.
I'm sorry. No.
There's a mistake.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
Moonlight won.
Come on. This is not a joke.
This is not a joke. I'm afraid they read the wrong thing.
This is not a joke. Moonlight has won Best Picture. Moonlight, Best Picture.
I think you guys should keep...
Warren, what did you do?
I want to tell you what happened. I opened the envelope, and it said, Emma Stone, La La Land. That's why I took such a long look at Faye and at you. I wasn't trying to be funny.
Well, you were funny.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Wow, this is...
This is Moonlight.
We're the biggest screw-up in live television history. Oh, my goodness. Last night, the Academy Awards. Warren Beatty, Faye Dunaway presenting Best Picture. As you just saw, they announced La La Land with the actual winner... was Moonlight. Talk about unbelievable. The Academy says this has never happened in their history. They even have safeguards in place where PricewaterhouseCoopers, the accountants, they actually memorize all of the winners. And so if anything like this happens, then they literally send somebody out saying, hey, you got it wrong. What ended up happening was Warren Beatty somehow walked on stage with the envelope that said, Best Actress. That's why he read Emma Stone. Talk about absolutely embarrassing. And then what happens? The stagehand then runs out and is saying, oh my God, it was Moonlight. Pandemonium last night. Moonlight, of course, a movie made less than $2 million, comes away a huge winner last night at the Academy Awards. Let's talk about this with our panel. Scott Bolger, the attorney here in D.C., Lauren Victoria Burke, NBC Black, Eugene Craig, as well, Republican strategist. Yo! Somewhere Steve Harvey is like, man, praise the Lord!
He's been vindicated. But I tell you what, Steve Harvey showed him how to clean it up. But, you know, it took a while for them to clean it up. And I had this vision in my mind of them being backstage with Deloitte arguing about what to do. Do you let it go and correct it later or do it now? And the stagehand and the producer says, we got to do this right now. And he runs out. And remember, he snatches it from Warren Beatty and holds it up in the middle of pandemonium.
And that was the deal. That was the deal, Lauren and Eugene, that was amazing. No one knew what to do. Yeah. And it was the dude from La La Land who said, okay, because actually, if you see it, the PricewaterhouseCooper guy tries to take the card from Beatty, and the La La guy's like, here, y'all, and say it's Moonlight.
Yeah, that was Jordan Horowitz, one of the producers of La La Land, who handled this really well. I would not have handled it so well.
Better than anybody else.
He really did.
He handled it better than
everything.
Warren Beatty, better than Jimmy Kimmel, better than PricewaterhouseCooper.
Now, PricewaterhouseCooper, to me, took way too long. They were into two speeches by the time, and you can see people running around the background, of course, but you're into two speeches before you figure out that the best picture category is the wrong one. And see, apparently, from what I've read, I mean, obviously I wasn't there, but apparently there's two envelopes, and Beatty got the second envelope. Emma Stone, of course, got the first one for best actress. But my thing is, you're at the last category. How many envelopes are back there? So it, to me, was excruciating. And really, the La La Land people and the Moonlight people really handled it a lot better than anybody else. Unbelievable. Man, unbelievable.
Can we win without? Can we get a W without it being some controversy around it?
Oh, man.
I mean, Moonlight was obviously the best picture of the year. You know, it's a great win for, you know, for the culture. They did it for the culture.
All the folks with Hidden Figures and Fences would disagree with you on that.
Well, you know, the Oscars doesn't, it's not about, you know, popular vote, it's about what the Academy thinks.
It would be a night that would live in infamy.
Man.
Well, but again.
That was bad.
Well, here's one of the things that got me
because
here.
You can see Beatty saw the envelope. Nope. He knew something was wrong.
He hesitates.
Right. He looks at the
envelope. Because he was like, what the hell?
He shows it to Dunaway. Of course, Dunaway reads.
But here's what's crazy. Shelly, go to my iPad. Okay, so this is from the ABC website. Okay. The envelope says actress in a leading role.
Right.
The PricewaterhouseCooper people said that Beatty took the wrong envelope. No. Who's the person handing the envelope?
Right.
He doesn't walk around and go, give me that one right there.
Right.
No.
Right.
That one.
Actually, in fairness to him, too, the category is at the bottom of that card. It's not at the top.
Right. So no, at the bottom in very small letters.
Right.
You would think it would be at the top in huge letters. Best picture, Moonlight. Why would you put the smallest print?
Right.
And you can tell he was kind of like.
And he's got to take the whole card out of the envelope to see the category.
But he's literally going.
You know, it's your card design has to be.
But in 2017, why are we still awarding awards like this on paper? Why don't we just do it electronically?
No, because their deal is nobody else knows the results.
Do you want Russia hacking those Oscars?
And they don't want it in any electronic form, in case it somehow gets hacked or get out.
But there's got to be a better way to do this.
Somebody back there should have been like, wait a minute, the best picture is not.
This is just me. If the best picture is coming up, there's somebody sitting here going, sir, this is your envelope for best picture.
That's it.
Walk out on stage.
That's all you got to do.
But when you hear it wrong, you should be launching out of your seat.
No, but again, I'm just trying to understand why somebody's going, what's the next award?
Right.
Best picture.
The last
Here's
award.
The envelope. It's only one left.
Come on. Now, do you think after Denzel getting a snub, they're going to let Moonlight get best picture without some kind of, you know, commotion around it?
Bottom line, look, you look Moonlight, hey, we won.
Right.
We're good.
Right.
We're fine.
Culture, baby.
But, oh, my God, that's crazy. Woo. All right, so, folks, later in the show, we'll have more about the big winners last night, including Viola Davis, who won for Best Supporting Actress, even though she was actually the best actress. But that's a whole other story. So we'll have more on that later in the show. So let's talk about the NAACP. They are calling for economic boycott in North Carolina over what they say continuing efforts by Republicans to actually rig the vote there. Voter suppression is a major issue. Of course, the House bill that dealt with the issue of transgender bathrooms, plus that same bill, which nobody talks about, prevents cities from passing their own minimum wage laws. Well, this weekend, NAACP had their news conference, and they say it's time to make North Carolina feel the pain.
We have won in the courts. We have won at the ballot box.
Yeah.
And still, we have extremists that want to attempt to undermine those victories.
Yep.
And so when you've won in the courts and you've won in the ballot box, sometimes you have to go to the cash register. To let it be known that we will not go backwards when it comes to voting rights, when it comes to human rights, and when it comes to civil rights.
All right, folks, let's go back to our panel on this particular issue. Look, North Carolina NAACP and others have been involved in massive protests since 2007. They have been mobilizing people. They have been targeting, of course, the Republicans there in North Carolina. As Reverend Dr. William Barber just said, they've been beating back all of these different challenges, and they laid out five different things they want. They're saying, hey, let's use the power of our dollars. Already, the NBA pulled the All-Star game out of Charlotte. That's when they went to New Orleans this year. The NCAA has made it clear, because of the transgender bathroom bill, they're not going to hold any NCAA championship events there as well. North Carolina has already lost billions from other companies. You would think broke folks would realize that it's kind of stupid, the games they're playing there. Eugene, I'll start with you. And Virginia, I love it during the election. Virginia newspaper took an editorial out and telling North Carolina, thank you. They endorsed Pat McCrory for governor, saying, please, because you're sending us lots of jobs.
So my issue with this is this. You know, the NAACP in North Carolina chooses to announce the boycott during the biggest black spending weekend in North Carolina. CIAA weekend. The other divisions and the NCAA decided to pull out. The CIAA and HBCUs, who's being affected, whose folk that support these schools are being affected right now, should have pulled out of Charlotte. You know, you don't announce it during CIAA weekend.
First of all, the announcement was a discussion of a boycott. They have not fully launched an economic boycott. This is the shot.
It's across, the next step along the
But this is the shot across the bow. Now, what happens next year for CIAA is a whole different story.
Yeah, you know, I think Reverend Barber right now and his coalition in North Carolina that you called the Mississippi of 2017.
The Alabama 21st.
Alabama 21st.
And Mississippi.
And Mississippi. Take your pick. Is the most effective coalition right now out here. And this is a natural progression because you're right. They've won in the courts. They've won at the ballot box. And so now they're going to win with the wallets. These Republicans in North Carolina are special. They are highly resistant. They don't care. They win at all costs. They defy the ballot box. They defy the court system. And the wallet piece and boycotting, I hope they do it. You got to be disciplined to do that now, because you can ultimately wind up hurting a lot of black people as well, but it's necessary in North Carolina right now.
Yeah, we always hear the theory that, well, black people will get hurt if we do a boycott. We heard that after Trayvon Martin. People want to boycott Florida.
We heard it in Black Freedom
and
Movement.
We hear that all the time. Yeah. We're already hurting. I mean, we already got 28% of our children are in poverty. You know, I think we can tough it out. You know, the only thing that people respond to politically is power and money, money and power. That's it. So it would seem to me that a boycott would be a very good idea, and a very overdue idea.
We'll redirect that dial to a black business.
Well, it's also about getting this state to understand that, all right, if that's how y'all want to roll,
right.
Okay, but you're going to feel the economic pain. We saw what happened when the Polaroid workers led the divestment campaign in South Africa. South Africa was brought to its knees economically.
Right.
Okay. North Carolina, now the crazy folks in South Carolina didn't care when it came to the boycott of the NAACP, when it came to the Confederate flag, and so they still want to wave their flag. North Carolina is a totally different state. The research triangle there, you have
banking
different
center.
Economic factions there, banking as well. I would think that folks there are going to say, okay, the last thing we can do is keep losing billions of dollars in this state. And as Dr. King said on April 3rd, 1968, at Mason Temple in Memphis, it's time to redistribute the pain.
Yep. And just losing the events that would have come to the state over the transgender issue, which is an issue that impacts a lot fewer people than what Moral Mondays focuses on. The voting piece alone, in fact, impacts thousands. You know, to me, they should go for it. They should go for the full boy, because the embarrassment alone will cause people to stay away from the state.
And in fact, one of the mistakes that people also keep making, that particular bill was not just about transgender bathrooms.
Right.
In that bill, they prohibited cities from passing their own minimum wage laws. I thought Eugene Republicans love local control.
Right.
I've said it before. North Carolina Republicans are a special breed of folk.
They're a breed.
These are the same folk that offed their first African-American chairman.
Republican.
Republican chairman. Right. And so, you know, they get no defense out of me.
We got to take North Carolina out behind the barn and just beat them down, what my mother and grandmother used to say.
Well,
you got to show them.
Getting the
governor
out.
Because telling them isn't enough. And you got to stay organized on the ground. You got to keep winning in the courts and keep winning in the ballot box and then connect it to the economic issue.
All right, folks, hold tight 1 second. When we come back, we'll talk about the Democratic National Committee race. Oh, my goodness, that was some drama. Can the factions supporting Tom Perez and Keith Ellison actually come together to show some Democratic unity? Well, we'll discuss that next. Also, HBCUs will have the attention of the White House this week. We'll explain to you what's going to happen there as well. 15 after the hour, News One Now on TV One.
So you want the truth. Well, we got it.
That's how I talk. God knows it. I'm just straight.
It's News One Now.
I saw the news that former Congressman J.C. Watts is actually behind the effort for the Black News Channel. He's been trying to do that for several years. It's in partnership with Florida A&M. So certainly big congratulations for them, that $30 million broadcast facility they have there. So I look forward to actually going down there and seeing it one day. So looking forward to that. Congratulations,
by
folks.
By the way, Roland, Trump has already banned them.
Well, of course, yeah, because he's already called that fake news. Also, Tom, shout out to Community Baptist Church of Englewood, New Jersey. I was there yesterday for the Black History Month program. Packed house, and so certainly enjoyed my time speaking with them in the General Baptist Convention on Saturday. Speaking of Saturday, big vote in Atlanta. Well, Democrats elected a new chair of the Democratic National Committee. They chose former Labor Secretary Tom Perez over Congressman Keith Ellison, a 235-200 vote, did not make Ellison voters happy. Of course, he was also backed big time by Senator Bernie Sanders. Perez immediately moved to suspend the rules and name Ellison vice chair of the party. Of course, Donald Trump, he also weighed in with a tweet, congratulations to Thomas Perez, he goes by Tom, who has just been named chairman of the DNC. I could not be happier for him or for the Republican Party. And he then later, of course, tried to say the election was rigged, and that's why they lost. Lord, please take this man's damn phone. And then Tom Perez tweeted back, call me Tom. He tweeted back to Trump, call me Tom, and don't get too happy. Keith Ellison and I are in Democrats United across the country will be your worst nightmare. Joining us right now, folks, a couple of guests. One is Cornell Belcher, top Democratic pollster who joins us. Also, Jordan Sheridan. He, of course, is a reporter with the Young Turks. First to you, Cornell. What is the path forward for Tom Perez trying to rebuild the party, not nationally, but really on the state level, where more than 1,000 seats were lost under the tenure of President Barack Obama?
Good morning, and thanks for having me on. I think the path forward is, you know, Perez has got to be a little bit of former Chairman Terry McAuliffe, now Governor McAuliffe, and former Chair Howard Dean. And what I say by that is Terry was, or Governor McAuliffe now, was very good at raising money and helping to build. Governor Dean, as you know, was very good and instrumental at building the 50-state strategy, getting down to the state and local level, very grassroots neighbor-to-neighbor program. What you've seen over the last 8 years is, in fact, the Democratic Party not putting resources, not putting time and people in the ground across the country, particularly at the sort of the local level where you have to win some of these local elections in order for you to win at the federal level. So a lot of people complain, especially in the states, that the party has really rotted at the local level, and the party now must be rebuilt. So Perez has got to raise a lot of money, and he's got to do a lot of organizing.
Jordan, you were not happy at all. You were a big Bernie Sanders supporter. You were blasting the selection of Tom Perez.
Yeah, you know, it's just that same old record spinning. It seems like not a lot was learned from the defeat in November. You know, all you hear about with Tom Perez and the DNC race is the 50-state strategy. We got to reboot the states. But if you don't have the policies right, if you don't have excitement, particularly among young people, it doesn't really matter if you have the mechanical or the structures right, or you galvanize more money. I think that Tom Perez really represents the establishment insider wing, And that's not going to get out the millennials that supported Bernie Sanders or middle-aged to older people that supported Bernie Sanders. This was a moment to really go in a different direction, and they stayed the course.
But Cornell, when you look at, it's interesting because on the other hand, you have people who say Tom Perez had a strong record as labor secretary. Others say that he was a strong advocate for civil rights when he served in the Department of Justice. So which is it?
It's kind of mind-boggling to me, and I do respect those who are frustrated, but it's kind of mind-boggling to me, because if you look at the Democratic Party right now, and if you look at the policy of the Democratic Party right now, you can't. It's kind of hard to argue that the Democratic Party is not a progressive place. And if you look at where Tom Perez is, and you look at where Ellison was on 99% of all the important sort of issues that are important to young people and important to old people as well across this country, there's not an inch of difference between the two, right? And quite frankly, the chair of the party is not, in fact, a politician. The chair of the party is a builder and a fundraiser. And yes, they have to sort of give the voice and the values of the party. But I doubt very seriously that there is a policy perspective.
So will that be the vice chair?
That's important to young people. That is not important to Perez. Look, I you know, we can't always win, right? But right now we have to come together and fight an existential threat to our democracy in Donald Trump and what his movement is, and Perez will do that.
Okay, so if you don't like Tom Perez, who would you have liked to have seen get the chairmanship?
Jordan?
Keith Ellison, I think, and I disagree with Cornell on that, because one of the biggest reasons we always lose in midterms is young people don't vote. Young people tend to vote in actual election, presidential election years, but not the midterms. You just galvanize, well, not you, but Bernie Sanders and the progressive movement just galvanized millions of young people, and four or five months later, you're basically leaving them on the doorstep.
But Jordan, I got to ask you this here. Here's the whole deal, okay? Okay, so if that's the case, that's young people asking Democrats, can you please do this? This is why you run for county chair and county positions. This is why you run for state positions. Young folks who support Bernie Sanders were not going to just take over the party in a matter of months. This, look, in 1984, Reverend Jackson did the exact same thing. 1988, Reverend Jackson did the exact same thing. What he did in 84 after losing, he comes in 88, comes in second to Michael Dukakis. They all of a sudden get Ron Brown as chair, change the rules when it came to superdelegates, change the rules when it came to proportional delegation versus winner take all. And so if you're a Bernie supporter, you're going to have to actually take the time to get in the party and then take over powerful positions and not hope somebody else do it. And so shouldn't you be saying to those folks, that's what your job should be, to do that?
Oh, absolutely. But the two aren't mutually exclusive. And this talking point that they didn't have much policy differences is not true.
But you got to have votes. And if you don't have the positions, you don't have the votes.
Yeah, correct. But my point is,
but where are they different on the policy? I mean, where's the Democratic Party practical on policy? There's not a fraction of the Democratic Party around policy.
One wants to break up the big banks, the other one doesn't. One actually tried to go after banks that defrauded people on their mortgages. The other one didn't. I mean, there's many policy differences.
But you have a man who's representing that with the vice chair. Isn't that going to make a difference in Keith Ellison?
Honestly, I mean, deputy chair, it seems a little more symbolic than anything else to me. I'm all for Keith Ellison being deputy chair, but really it's party operatives who are citing unity. If you're out in the country,
so that
like
would be
I
a
am, if you're out in the country like I am and you talk to thousands of people, there is no unity. This is operatives would like there to be unity, but there is a 50-50 split in the Democratic
Party.
Well,
I tell you what, if you want a 50-50 split, expect to lose again. But if you don't want to lose in 2018 and see Trump having a two-term, I say you better figure out how to get together real damn soon. Cornell Belcher, Jordan Charity, we appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
You want to see two-term, get it together.
Got to.
Real damn soon.
Real damn soon. Shoot, yeah. Hugging next.
All right, Todd, thank you so very much. I want to quickly go to our panel right here. Jordan and Cornell, thanks a bunch. I certainly appreciate it. Folks, again, your thoughts.
This is a huge problem for the Democrats. And the message you just gave your guest who was for Keith Ellison, you could give the same message to Tom Perez and the Democratic insiders. They can't win anything. On one hand, Ellison and Sanders Democrats can't figure out how to win.
Okay, but let's stop right there. First of all, and this is, I think, again, I'll keep making this point. And this is what you're also seeing. You're seeing, you say Sanders Democrats. He's not a Democrat. Now, is he a man? No, wait, one second. Bernie Sanders remains an independent in the United States Senate.
Bernie Sanders ran on
the Democratic side and then still said he was not going to join the party. Now, here's the piece here, okay? Bernie Sanders, folks, lost the nomination, lost the DNC chair. I'm going to say it again, Eugene. If you don't run for county and state, you will never be able to take over the party.
So as somebody coming out of the 2012 election, 2013, got onto our Baltimore County Central Committee, and then two years later, ended up as the vice chair of a state party. You don't change the party by, you know, one full swoop taking out a chairman. You change the party by changing the actual structure and infrastructure of the party. That takes you running. That takes you running for party office. That takes you running for local and county office.
And we've seen that.
I came out of the Ron Paul Revolution out of 2012. You know, we know if there's anybody that knows what it feels like to be slapped down by the establishment.
For some reason, there's an obsession with Sanders, Bernie Sanders, Bernie Sanders. They lost 1,000 seats.
Are they still
Bernie
feeling
Sanders
burn?
Ever showed up. They lost 63 House seats because of OFA and Barack Obama's benign neglect before Bernie Sanders. Okay, when everybody was together, this president, the Democrat. Did the bank bailout, agree with the bank bailout, agreed with TPP, agreed with the Bush tax cuts. So this whole thing of Sanders isn't a Democrat.
But here's the deal, though. Very same people who are saying they were backing Keith Ellison, they also loved Obama.
Yeah.
See, so hold up. The same people.
What are you talking
about? No, what I'm talking about is the very same people can't sit here. Lauren, the very same people who were saying, oh yeah, Sanders is our guy and he's right on the issues. The same millennials were loving Obama.
Lauren, if you just said
that Obama's position when it came to the bank bailout, when it came to TPP, when it came to all those different issues.
Those people lost a thousand seats
because what they did was they became a national party and ignore ground what happened on the ground.
Right, and they were in charge of that.
I understand that. What I'm saying is...
the same people who effed up are back again.
And this is the point, and this is what I'm still saying.
You don't understand that?
Let me be real clear. If you do not run for county committee, if you do not run for state committee, you cannot take over a party.
Follow me here. Whose biggest seat was city council in a blue state?
Follow me here, Lauren. And you were DC committee. You were DC Democratic Party chair.
You know
how the game works. If you want power, you must take power.
What's going to
you
say
don't?
What's
one second,
gonna...
Lauren. Lauren, one second. What you do not do. You don't sit back and go, we don't like who's in charge. Can y'all please change?
The Sanders Democrats
are saying more than that. They're saying that they can't take power. They want change. They don't want a power share. They want leadership, and that the rules are forgive the term, rigged against him. That's fair.
Well, Scott,
that's fair.
We have examples. We have examples in a number of states where they have actually taken control of county and state. And what I'm saying is you are not going to be able to think that you're going to take over the whole party in 3 months.
I don't think they think that.
What I do, hold on.
What I do think they believe, though, is that they need to reform and rebuild the Democratic Party in the image and as the Sander Democrats and be more progressive, more liberal, to go after Trump. And if Tom Perez doesn't unify and power share with the Sander Democrats, it doesn't matter whether they did a 50-state strategy.
If the Sander Democrats and the Sanders youth movement keeps going down this path, they're going to keep feeling the burn of these L's.
What they need to do is ignore the Democratic Party and listen to Indivisible, because Indivisible is about to save the Democratic Party from itself.
But I'm sorry, last I checked, Bernie Sanders was supposed to convert his campaign to a group called the Revolution. Will you please listen? Senator Bernie Sanders, with his mailing list and his apparatus, they were converting that into exactly what you just said.
Once an entity that is not part of the party.
If you have the apparatus and then you were to convert that, that's how you run candidates. That's how you raise money. All I'm saying is this here. As somebody who has taken over organizations, you don't do it by just yelling. You do it by getting in and then you say, fine, we're going to take it over.
That's how you take it over.
Guess what? And it ain't going to happen over 2 months. I got to go to a break. When we come back, I do got to go right now because you done made your point.
I gotta go.
That's right. You got enough time now. You couldn't make your point in that time? Well, that's your problem. When we come back, we'll talk HBCUs and President Donald Trump next. News 1 now on TV 1.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News 1 now with Roland Martin. Every weekday morning at 7 on TV 1.
The Trump administration has put HBCUs on its radar screen this week. The president will sign an executive order as early as today that will give a big funding boost to more than 100 schools around the country. And HBCU presidents will be meeting with the administration on Tuesday to discuss the school's importance and ways in which government and corporations can support them.
I also want to honor and promote the achievements of historically black colleges and universities throughout our nation. They do a fantastic job. They're not given the credit that they deserve, and they're going to start getting that credit.
Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina, Congressman Mark Walker of North Carolina are hosting a day-long conference with the school leaders tomorrow at the Library of Congress. Omarosa Manigault, Director of Communications for the Office of Public Liaison in the Administration, plus Senior Advisor to the President, will take part in the conference. Joining us right now, Leslie Baskerville, President and CEO of the National Association for Equal Opportunity, which, of course, advocates for HBCUs. So, Leslie, what do you make of the Trump administration trying to get a feather in his cap with black folks by appealing to HBCUs?
Well, actually, during the campaign, President Trump talked about HBCUs. No one heard it because of the vitriol and all that was going on.
In the campaign,
he talked about HBCUs, and then simultaneously, his ground troops in Florida and some of the Deep South, they had listening sessions on HBCU campuses. And so there was a common thread, and it was spurred by Omarosa Manigault, who's a three-time HBCU alumna. She graduated from Central State University in Ohio, from Payne Theological Seminary in Ohio, and from Howard University. And so she has been a voice and a champion for HBCUs throughout the campaign. And one of the things that she said in listening sessions early on was that President Trump understood the centrality of HBCUs to his agenda.
Do you believe that?
That he understands that?
Right.
I think that it is important that he has someone at his side that he trusts who knows firsthand the centrality of HBCUs to the realization of his economic agenda, his education agenda, his agenda to revitalize urban areas and rural areas and so forth.
But here's what you have. 94% of black women voted against Donald Trump for president. Mm-hmm. Black folks are not shy about their feelings about Donald Trump. That's what the HBCU presidents are going to go up against. Talladega College, well, they decided to perform in the inauguration. They caught a whole lot of heat from their graduates, from the alumni about that decision. And so, what is the fine line HBCU presidents must walk?
What HBCU presidents must say, and what I say to everyone and wise people say, no permanent friends, no permanent enemies, permanent interests. In this president, we have someone who has said, because of diversity, and I think it's important to note that, we talk about the importance of diversity from the top down in all the ranks here in the White House. We've had people of color, we've had females there. Here we have a diversity of experiences, a diversity of institutions. And so someone who understands the value of HBCUs, they're just 3% of American colleges, 40% of African Americans in the sciences, technology, engineering, and mathematics graduating there, 60% health professionals graduating, 50% African American teachers. So she, Omarosa Manigault, and now I understand there are at least three other persons in between the Office of Public Policy and the Office of Outreach that have experiences as HBCU alumni.
The plan is to move the HBCU initiative out of the Department of Education, move it to the White House, smart or not, Eugene?
I'll put it this way. I'd probably rather keep it in the Department of Education rather than the hands of Omarosa Manigault. As somebody that's dealt with her, somebody that's a Republican that believes in HBCUs, somebody that's attended HBCUs, I'm very excited about executive order, but I want to see executive order plus legislation from Congress that's actually enforceable rather than something that gives Omarosa a nice press release.
It's a piece of paper.
Who cares
though.
Whether or
what
not?
What gets you excited about an executive order that directs agencies to be more supportive and to use and contract and give grant priority to historical black colleges from the Trump administration? What's exciting about that unless it comes with accountability and real action?
So we propose that it does. The HBCU community.
That it does what?
Puts in accountability. So the executive order and the White House initiatives on HBCUs has actually been in the White House previously, and then it was taken in the department. When it was in the department, it got mired in the politics of the department. So the first thing that it does when you take it out of the department is it signals its importance to the administration. And the messaging is to the people, the heads of the departments and the agencies, that this is very important to this administration. It signaled that to the Republican leadership in Congress. And so, as was said earlier in the feed coming in, our presidents are going to meet early in this Congress with the Republican leadership, thanks to Congressman Walker and Senator Tim Scott and a range of other people. But so they signal, number one, the importance. Number two, we're proposing, and I don't know if it's going to be in there, but that there is a 5% goal for increasing federal investment, every federal agency, every federal department, contracts, grants, sponsored programs, internships, and so forth. That accounts to a substantial amount of dollars. And there is a report, I don't know what's in it, we have recommended a reporting requirement.
For every black college, that 5% investment?
For the HBCU community across the board. And so the agencies and departments under our proposal would need to show progress toward that goal.
After 8 years of what we just saw, the only thing I'm caught up in is whether or not something is going to happen for HBCUs or not going to happen. Mm-hmm. I couldn't care less whether that office was in the White House or not in the White House. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Obama administration had all these decorative offices on African-American education, and they had the William Harvey thing, and they had, you know, Ivory Tolson, and nothing happened for HBCUs. The situation got worse. So don't you think the way this should be measured at the end of the day is, are these schools getting money or are they not getting money?
Absolutely. Outcomes, and we propose that there's an outcome outcome measures. President Reagan actually had goals and outcome measures. He required his departments and agencies to report mid-year and end of the year, and you'll see that the federal dollars going in did increase. At least you can hold them accountable. But I mean, I think you're absolutely right. And back to the discussion you all were just having, if the HBCU community sits on the sideline and does nothing, then nothing will happen. But if we go in this opening, we have a president who has said,
absolutely,
we want to do something and we have to go in that opening and try to make it happen.
I don't disagree with you. I don't disagree with you. But here's the thing. Our historical black colleges, we usually categorize them in three groups. Those who are struggling and can't meet budget on a monthly or annual basis, those who are barely meeting budget, and those who are achieving and have a significant endowment. I worry that some of those historical black colleges aren't in a position, the ones that are struggling, aren't in a position to even accept that 5% or accept the more focused investment in their institutions because they're just not in a position to manage it and to receive it. You make it sound
whatever,
like it's simple.
Whatever they're willing to accept, it's better than the 8 years we just saw.
That's certainly true.
Okay. I agree 100%.
One other point is the Parent PLUS loan, right, is the order going to cover and improve or fix the Parent PLUS loan credit requirements
that devastated historical black colleges? If it does, it'd be a big turnaround. If the Trump EO does that, that would be a huge win for HBCUs.
Exactly.
A huge win for black and brown
colleges.
A correction of a failed Obama policy.
Final comment.
So, the final comment, I think that is important that, first of all, distinguish between what an executive order can do and then what legislation has to do. And obviously, on the side of legislation, we're going to push like the dickens to remediate the residual adverse impacts of
those
the shifts.
And,
absolutely. Right. But I don't agree with you in your characterization of HBCUs. HBCUs span the gamut from small to research intensive. Whatever it is, they have astounding leaderships who are doing more with few dollars than anyone else. If you put any additional dollars in any of those institutions, they will be stronger, they will thrive, they will grow, and continue to outpace others. HBCUs are punching above their weight in every class, even with so few resources.
And we're dealing with this tomorrow as well. So, Leslie, we appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for being here.
All right, don't move y'all up. When we come back, folks, the music industry mourns two unsung musicians, Clyde Stubblefield and Leon Ware. We'll give tribute to their legacy coming up. Plus, more on the Oscars. Viola Davis finally nabs her a golden statue. News 1 Now, TV 1, back in a moment.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with Roland Martin. Roland Martin.
Soul singer, producer, songwriter Leon Ware died Thursday at the age of 77. While Ware was a prolific singer who recorded more than 10 solo albums, he is best known for the love songs that he produced and wrote for other R&B performers over his 50-year music career. It was Ware's sensual lyrics that defined the sound of Marvin Gaye in 1976 with the song and album I Want You. Ware's vast repertoire of writing credits also include I Want to Be Where You Are, recorded by Michael Jackson, and Something Something by Maxwell. In a 2008 documentary, Ware explained how he viewed his lyrics. He said, quote, people can say very, very sexy things, but it lacks sensuality. The lack of sensuality is like the difference in having sex and making love. Ware had reportedly undergone treatment for prostate cancer in recent years, but no cause of death has been given at this time. Also, folks, we lost the great drummer Clyde Stubblefield. He was a significant drummer, of course, played with James Brown and others. He died of kidney failure at the age of 73. Stubblefield toured with James Brown for 6 years. At the beginning of his professional career, his drum beats were heard in James Brown anthems such as Cold Sweat, Say It Loud, and Funky Drummer. Known as the most sampled drummer in the world, Stubblefield's beats have been heard on thousands of songs, including Public Enemy's Fight the Power, LL Cool J's Mama Said Knock You Out, Boogie Down Productions, South Bronx, and so many others. In later years, the industry began to give Stubblefield his props publicly. In 2011, he performed Fight the Power on The Tonight Show, starring Jimmy Fallon, along with Chuck D and members of The Roots. Questlove of The Roots told the New York Times, quote, they have been faster and they have been stronger, but Clyde Stubblefield has a marksman left hand unlike any drummer in the 20th century. It is he who defined funk
music to celebrate the life of two great legends. Next on News One Now, we'll talk more drama at the Oscars, plus Viola Davis finally wins the big one. Back in a moment.
Your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America.
I don't bend, I don't break.
It's News One Now with Roland Martin.
Viola Davis was a vision of joy. She won her Oscar for actress in a supporting role. She and Whoopi Goldberg are the only black actresses to win an Oscar, Emmy, and a Tony. But Whoopi also won a Grammy. Davis gave an emotional speech that had tears, in the eyes of her and many in the audience.
Thank you to the Academy. You know, there's one place that all the people with the greatest potential are gathered. One place. And that's the graveyard. People ask me all the time, what kind of stories do you want to tell, Viola? And I say, exhume those bodies. Exhume those stories. The stories of the people who dreamed big and never saw those dreams to fruition. People who fell in love and lost. I became an artist, and thank God I did, because we are the only profession that celebrates what it means to live a life. So here's to August Wilson, who exhumed and exalted the ordinary people. And to Braun Pictures, Paramount, Macro, Todd Black, Molly Allen, Scott Rudin for being the cheerleaders for a movie that is about people and words and life and forgiveness and grace. And to Michael T. Williamson, Stephen McKinley Henderson, Russell Hornsby, Giovanna Deppel, Sanaya Cindy for being the most wonderful artists I've ever worked with. And, oh, Captain, my Captain, Denzel Washington. Thank you for putting two entities in the driving seat, August and God. And they served you well. And to Dan and May Ellis Davis, who were this and are the center of my universe, the people who taught me good or bad, how to fail, how to love, how to hold an award, how to lose. My parents, I'm so thankful that God chose you to bring me into this world. To my sisters, my sister Dolores, who's here, who played Jaji and Jaja with me. We were rich white women in the Tea Party games. Thank you for the imagination. And to my husband and my daughter, my heart, you and Genesis, you teach me every day how to live, how to love. I'm so glad that you are the foundation of my life. Thank you to the Academy. Thank you.
Folks, Barry Jenkins, after all the drama, did address Moonlight winning Best Picture.
Very clearly, even in my dreams, this could not be true. But to hell with dreams, I'm done with it, because this is true. Oh my goodness. And it is true, it's not fake. We've been on the road with these guys for so long, and that was so gracious and so generous of them. My love to La La Land, my love to everybody. Man. You know, there was a time when I thought this movie was impossible because I couldn't bring it to fruition. I couldn't bring myself to tell another story. And so everybody behind me on the stage said, no, that is not acceptable. So I just want to thank everybody up here behind me, everybody out there in that room, because we didn't do this. You guys chose us. Thank you for the choice. I appreciate it.
Mahershala Ali won for Best Supporting Actor for Moonlight, the first Muslim to win an Academy Award. Here's his acceptance speech.
My grandma would want me to button up. I want to thank my teachers, my professors. I had so many wonderful teachers. And one thing that they consistently told me, Zelda Fitzhandler, Ron Van Loo, Ken Washington, is that it wasn't about you. It's not about you. It's about these characters. You're a servant. You're in service to these stories and these characters. And I'm so blessed to have had an opportunity. It was about Juan.
Also, folks, Ezra Edelman and Caroline Waterlow, they won Best Documentary Feature for O.J. Made in America. And so, folks, real quick, obviously, Oscars got a lot of heat last year for Oscars So White. There was some difference this year, but Hollywood ain't off the hook.
Denzel and Hidden Figures. and Hidden Figures. Although, yeah, it was a historic night. It was a great night. Who knew that Moonlight was going to win Best Picture? Nobody thought that. Yeah. So that was fantastic. But, man, Hidden Figures did not getting anything?
Yeah. And keep in mind, out of all the roles Denzel has played, he still is only one Best Actor for Training Day.
Yep.
Yeah. He should have gotten for Malcolm X.
Yep.
This is a positive role. But listen, this success this year would not have been possible without the protests and the ongoing protests.
I want one quick thing. I want to give a shout to Taylor Barfield, who's a Bowie State HBCU alum, for her work on production of 30 Under 30 ESPN, OJ movie.
Cool. Back in 60 seconds, News 19 TV 1.
Your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America.
I don't bend, I don't break.
It's News 1 Now with Roland Martin.
Shout-out singer Bobby Valentino turns 37. Sports analyst and former NFL player Tony Gonzalez turns 41. Chili, member of the group TLC, turns 40. Is really, will you calm down? Lord Jesus, your wife is watching. She turns 46. All right, y'all, tomorrow on News 1 Now. Of course, we look forward to discussing HBCUs in the meeting with Trump in the White House. All right, we got to go. Y'all have a great one. Community Baptist Church of Inglewood, I appreciate it.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is, when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News 1 Now with Roland Martin.